and marrows and cucumbers, that every foot of ground appeared a vegetable treasury, while the smell of sweet herbs and all kinds of wholesome growth, to say nothing of the neighbouring meadows where the hay was carrying, made the whole air a great nosegay. Such stillness and composure reigned within the orderly precincts of the old red wall that even the feathers hung in garlands to scare the birds hardly stirred. And the wall had such a ripening influence that where, here and there, high up, a disused nail and scrap of list still clung to it, it was easy to fancy that they had mellowed with the changing seasons, and that they had rusted and decayed according to the common fate. The house, though a little disorderly in comparison with the garden, was a real old house with settles in the chimney of the brick-floored kitchen and great beams across the ceilings. On one side of it was the terrible piece of ground in dispute, where Mr. Boythorn maintained a sentry in a smock frock day and night, whose duty was supposed to be, in case of aggression, immediately to ring a large bell hung up there for the purpose, to unchain a great bulldog established in a kennel as his ally, and generally to deal destruction on the enemy. Not content with these precautions, Mr. Boythorn had himself composed and posted there, on painted boards to which his name was attached in large letters, the following solemn warnings: "Beware of the bulldog! He is most ferocious, Lawrence Boythorn. The blunderbuss is loaded with slugs, Lawrence Boythorn. Man-traps and spring-guns are set here at all times of the day and night, Lawrence Boythorn. Take notice that any person or persons audaciously presuming to trespass on this property will be punished with the utmost severity of private chastisement and prosecuted with the utmost rigour of the law, Lawrence Boythorn." These he showed us from the drawing-room window, while his bird was hopping about his head, and he laughed, ha 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 ha, to that extent, as he pointed them out, that I really thought he would have hurt himself. "But this is taking a good deal of trouble," said Mr. Skimpole, in his light way, "when you are not in earnest after all."
"Not in earnest?" returned Mr. Boythorn, with unspeakable warmth. "Not in earnest? If I could have hoped to train him, I would have bought a lion instead of that dog, and would have turned him loose upon the first intolerable robber who should dare to make an encroachment on my rights. Let Sir Leicester Dedlock consent to come out and decide this question by single combat, and I will meet him with any weapon known to mankind in any age or country. I am that much in earnest. Not more."
We arrived at his house on a Saturday. On the Sunday morning we all set forth to walk to the little church in the park. Entering the park, almost immediately by the disputed ground, we pursued a pleasant footpath winding among the verdant turf and the beautiful trees until it brought us to the church porch. The congregation was extremely small, and quite a rustic one, with the exception of a large muster of servants from the house, some of whom were already in their seats, while others were yet dropping in. There were some stately footmen, and there was a perfect picture of an old coachman who looked as if he were the official representative of all the pomps and vanities that had ever been put into his coach. There was a very pretty show of young women, and above them the handsome old face and fine, responsible, portly figure of the housekeeper towered pre-eminent. The pretty girl of whom Mr. Boythorn had told us was close by her. She was so very pretty that I might have known her by her beauty, even if I had not seen how blushingly conscious she was of the eyes of the young fisherman, whom I discovered not far off. One face, and not an agreeable one, though it was handsome, seemed maliciously watchful of this pretty girl, and indeed of every one and everything there. It was a Frenchwoman's. As the bell was yet ringing, and the great people were not yet come, I had leisure to glance over the church, which smelt as earthy as a grave, and to think what a shady, ancient, solemn little church it was. The windows, heavily shaded by trees, admitted a subdued light that made the faces around me pale, and darkened the old brasses in the pavement, and the time and damp-worn monuments, and rendered the sunshine in the little porch, where a monotonous ringer was working at the bell, inestimably bright. But a stir in that direction, a gathering of reverential awe in the rustic faces, and a blandly ferocious assumption on the part of Mr. Boythorn of being resolutely unconscious of somebody's existence, forewarned me that the great people were come, and that the service was going to begin. "Enter not into judgment with thy servant, O Lord, for in thy sight—" Shall I ever forget the rapid beating at my heart, occasioned by the look I met as I stood up? Shall I ever forget the manner in which those handsome, proud eyes seemed to spring out of their languor and to hold mine? It was only a moment before I cast mine down, released again, if I may say so, on my book. But I knew the beautiful face quite well in that short space of time. And very strangely there was something quickened within me, associated with the lonely days at my godmother's. Yes, away even to the days when I had stood on tiptoe to dress myself at my little glass after dressing my doll. And this, although I had never seen this lady's face before in all my life, I was quite sure of it, absolutely certain. It was easy to know that the ceremonious, gouty, grey-haired gentleman, the only other occupant of the great pew, was Sir Leicester Dedlock, and that the lady was Lady Dedlock. But why her face should be, in a confused way, like a broken glass to me, in which I saw scraps of old remembrances, and why I should be so fluttered and troubled, for I was still, by having casually met her eyes, I could not think. I felt it to be an unmeaning weakness in me, and tried to overcome it by attending to the words I heard. Then, very strangely, I seemed to hear them not in the reader's voice, but in the well-remembered voice of my godmother. This made me think, did Lady Dedlock's face accidentally resemble my godmother's? It might be that it did, a little. But the expression was so different, and the stern decision which had worn into my godmother's face like weather into rocks was so completely wanting in the face before me that it could not be that resemblance which had struck me. Neither did I know the loftiness and haughtiness of Lady Dedlock's face at all in any one. And yet I, little Esther Summerson, the child who lived a life apart, and on whose birthday there was no rejoicing, seemed to arise before my own eyes, evoked out of the past by some power in this fashionable lady whom I not only entertained no fancy that I had ever seen, but whom I perfectly well knew I had never seen until that hour. It made me tremble so to be thrown into this unaccountable agitation that I was conscious of being distressed even by the observation of the French maid, though I knew she had been looking watchfully here and there and everywhere from the moment of her coming into the church. By degrees, though very slowly, I at last overcame my strange emotion. After a long time, I looked towards Lady Dedlock again. It was while they were preparing to sing before the sermon. She took no heed of me, and the beating at my heart was gone. Neither did it revive for more than a few moments, when she once or twice afterwards glanced at Ada or at me through her glass. The service being concluded, Sir Leicester gave his arm with much taste and gallantry to Lady Dedlock, though he was obliged to walk by the help of a thick stick, and escorted her out of church to the pony carriage in which they had come. The servants then dispersed, and so did the congregation, whom Sir Leicester had contemplated all along, Mr. Skimpole said to Mr. Boythorn's infinite delight, as if he were a considerable landed proprietor in heaven.
"He believes he is," said Mr. Boythorn. "He firmly believes it. So did his father, and his grandfather, and his great-grandfather."
"Do you know," pursued Mr. Skimpole very unexpectedly to Mr. Boythorn, "it's agreeable to me to see a man of that sort."
"Is it?" said Mr. Boythorn.
"Say that he wants to patronise me," pursued Mr. Skimpole. "Very well. I don't object."
"I do," said Mr. Boythorn, with great vigour.
"Do you really?" returned Mr. Skimpole, in his easy, light vein. "But that's taking trouble, surely. And why should you take trouble? Here am I, content to receive things childishly as they fall out, and I never take trouble. I come down here, for instance, and I find a mighty potentate exacting homage. Very well, I say, mighty potentate, here is my homage. It's easier to give it than to withhold it. Here it is. If you have anything of an agreeable nature to show me, I shall be happy to see it. If you have anything of an agreeable nature to give me, I shall be happy to accept it." Mighty potentate replies, in effect, "This is a sensible fellow. I find him accord with my digestion and my bilious system. He doesn't impose upon me the necessity of rolling myself up like a hedgehog with my points outward. I expand, I open, I turn my silver lining outward like Milton's cloud, and it's more agreeable to both of us. That's my view of such things, speaking as a child."
"But suppose you went down somewhere else tomorrow," said Mr. Boythorn, "where there was the opposite of that fellow, or of this fellow. How then?"
"How then?" said Mr. Skimpole, with an appearance of the utmost simplicity and candour. "Just the same, then. I should say, my esteemed Boythorn, to make you the personification of our imaginary friend, my esteemed Boythorn, you object to the mighty potentate? Very good, so do I. I take it that my business in the social system is to be agreeable. I take it that everybody's business in the social system is to be agreeable. It's a system of harmony, in short. Therefore, if you object, I object. Now, excellent Boythorn, let us go to dinner."
"But excellent Boythorn might say," returned our host, swelling and growing very red, "I'll be—"
"I understand," said Mr. Skimpole. "Very likely he would."
"If I will go to dinner," cried Mr.
Boythorn in a violent burst, and stopping to strike his stick upon the ground.
"And he would probably add, is there such a thing as principle, Mr. Harold Skimpole?"
"To which Harold Skimpole will reply, you know," he returned in his gayest manner and with his utmost ingenuous smile, "upon my life, I've not the least idea. I don't know what it is you call by that name, or where it is, or who possesses it. If you possess it and find it comfortable, I'm quite delighted and congratulate you heartily. But I know nothing about it, I assure you, for I'm a mere child, and I lay no claim to it, and I don't want it. So, you see, excellent Boythorn and I will go to dinner after all."
This was one of many little dialogues between them, which I always expected to end, and which I dare say would have ended, under other circumstances, in some violent explosion on the part of our host. But he had so high a sense of his hospitable and responsible position as our entertainer, and my guardian laughed so sincerely at and with Mr. Skimpole as a child who blew bubbles and broke them all day long, that matters never went beyond this point. Mr. Skimpole, who always seemed quite unconscious of having been on delicate ground, then betook himself to beginning some sketch in the park which he never finished, or to playing fragments of airs on the piano, or to singing scraps of songs, or to lying down on his back under a tree and looking at the sky, which he couldn't help thinking, he said, was what he was meant for. It suited him so exactly. "Enterprise and effort," he would say to us on his back, "are delightful to me. I believe I am truly cosmopolitan. I have the deepest sympathy with them. I lie in a shady place like this and think of adventurous spirits going to the North Pole or penetrating to the heart of the torrid zone with admiration. Mercenary creatures ask, 'What is the use of a man's going to the North Pole? What good does it do?' I can't say, but for anything I can say, he may go for the purpose, though he don't know it, of employing my thoughts as I lie here. Take an extreme case. Take the case of the slaves on American plantations. I dare say they are worked hard. I dare say they don't altogether like it. I dare say theirs is an unpleasant experience on the whole. But they people the landscape for me. They give it a poetry for me. And perhaps that is one of the pleasanter objects of their existence. I'm very sensible of it, if it be, and I shouldn't wonder if it were." I always wondered on these occasions whether he ever thought of Mrs. Skimpole and the children, and in what point of view they presented themselves to his cosmopolitan mind. So far as I could understand, they rarely presented themselves at all. The week had gone round to the Saturday following that beating of my heart in the church, and every day had been so bright and blue that to ramble in the woods and to see the light striking down among the transparent leaves and sparkling in the beautiful interlacings of the shadows of the trees, while the birds poured out their songs and the air was drowsy with the hum of insects, had been most delightful. We had one favourite spot, deep in moss and last year's leaves, where there were some felled trees, from which the bark was all stripped off. Seated among these, we looked through a green vista, supported by thousands of natural columns, the whitened stems of trees, upon a distant prospect made so radiant by its contrast with the shade in which we sat, and made so precious by the arched perspective through which we saw it, that it was like a glimpse of the better land. Upon the Saturday we sat here, Mr. Jarndyce, Ada, and I, until we heard thunder muttering in the distance, and felt the large raindrops rattle through the leaves. The weather had been all the week extremely sultry, but the storm broke so suddenly, upon us at least in that sheltered spot, that before we reached the outskirts of the wood the thunder and lightning were frequent, and the rain came plunging through the leaves as if every drop were a great leaden bead. As it was not a time for standing among trees, we ran out of the wood and up and down the moss-grown steps, which crossed the plantation fence like two broad-staved ladders placed back to back, and made for a keeper's lodge which was close at hand. We had often noticed the dark beauty of this lodge, standing in a deep twilight of trees, and how the ivy clustered over it, and how there was a steep hollow near, where he had once seen the keeper's dog dive down into the fern as if it were water. The lodge was so dark within, now the sky was overcast, that we only clearly saw the man who came to the door when we took shelter there and put two chairs for Ada and me. The lattice windows were all thrown open, and we sat just within the doorway watching the storm. It was grand to see how the wind awoke and bent the trees, and drove the rain before it like a cloud of smoke, and to hear the solemn thunder, and to see the lightning. And while thinking with awe of the tremendous powers by which our little lives are encompassed, to consider how beneficent they are, and how upon the smallest flower and leaf there was already a freshness poured from all this seeming rage, which seemed to make creation new again. "Is it not dangerous to sit in so exposed a place?" "Oh, no, Esther dear," said Ada quietly. Ada said it to me, but I had not spoken. The beating of my voice came back again. I had never heard the voice, as I had never seen the face, but it affected me in the same strange way. Again, in a moment, there arose before my mind innumerable pictures of myself. Lady Dedlock had taken shelter in the lodge before our arrival there, and had come out of the gloom within. She stood behind my chair with her hand upon it. I saw her with her hand close to my shoulder when I turned my head. "I have frightened you," she said. No, it was not fright. Why should I be frightened? "I believe," said Lady Dedlock to my guardian, "I have the pleasure of speaking to Mr. Jarndyce."
"Your remembrance does me more honour than I had supposed it would, Lady Dedlock," he returned.
"I recognised you in church on Sunday. I am sorry that any local disputes of Sir Leicester's, they are not of his seeking, however, I believe, should render it a matter of some absurd difficulty to show you any attention here."
"I am aware of the circumstances," returned my guardian with a smile, "and am sufficiently obliged."
She had given him her hand in an indifferent way that seemed habitual to her, and spoke in a correspondingly indifferent manner, though in a very pleasant voice. She was as graceful as she was beautiful, perfectly self-possessed, and had the air, I thought, of being able to attract and interest anyone if she had thought it worth her while. The keeper had brought her a chair on which she sat in the middle of the porch between us. "Is the young gentleman disposed of whom you wrote to Sir Leicester about, and whose wishes Sir Leicester was sorry not to have it in his power to advance in any way?" she said, over her shoulder to my guardian.
"I hope so," said he.
She seemed to respect him, and even to wish to conciliate him. There was something very winning in her haughty manner, and it became more familiar, I was going to say more easy, but that could hardly be, as she spoke to him over her shoulder. "I presume this is your other ward, Miss Clare?" He presented Ada in form. "You will lose the disinterested part of your Don Quixote character," said Lady Dedlock to Mr. Jarndyce over her shoulder again, "if you only redress the wrongs of beauty like this. But present me," and she turned full upon me, "to this young lady too."
"Miss Summerson really is my ward," said Mr. Jarndyce. "I am responsible to no Lord Chancellor in her case."
"Has Miss Summerson lost both her parents?" said my lady.
"Yes."
"She is very fortunate in her guardian." Lady Dedlock looked at me, and I looked at her and said I was indeed. All at once she turned from me with a hasty air almost expressive of displeasure or dislike, and spoke to him over her shoulder again. "Ages have passed since we were in the habit of meeting, Mr. Jarndyce."
"A long time. At least I thought it was a long time, until I saw you last Sunday," he returned.
"What, even you are a courtier, or think it necessary to become one to me?" she said with some disdain. "I have achieved that reputation, I suppose."
"You have achieved so much, Lady Dedlock," said my guardian, "that you pay some little penalty, I dare say, but none to me."
"So much," she repeated, slightly laughing. "Yes." With her air of superiority and power and fascination, and I know not what, she seemed to regard Ada and me as little more than children. So, as she slightly laughed, and afterwards sat looking at the rain, she was as self-possessed and as free to occupy herself with her own thoughts as if she had been alone.
"I think you knew my sister when we were abroad together better than you know me," she said, looking at him again. "Yes, we happened to meet oftener," he returned.
"We went our several ways," said Lady Dedlock, "and had little in common even before we agreed to differ. It is to be regretted, I suppose, but it could not be helped." Lady Dedlock again sat looking at the rain. The storm soon began to pass upon its way. The shower greatly abated. The lightning ceased. The thunder rolled among the distant hills, and the sun began to glisten on the wet leaves and the falling rain. As we sat there silently, we saw a little pony phaeton coming towards us at a merry pace.
"The messenger is coming back, my lady," said the keeper, "with the carriage."
As it drove up, we saw that there were two people inside. There alighted from it, with some cloaks and wrappers, first the Frenchwoman, who I had seen in church, and secondly the pretty girl. The Frenchwoman with a defiant confidence, the pretty girl confused and hesitating.
"What now?" said Lady Dedlock. "Two?"
"I am your maid, my lady, at the present," said the Frenchwoman. "The message was for the attendant."
"I was afraid you might mean me, my lady," said the pretty girl.
"I did mean you, child," replied her mistress calmly. "Put that shawl on me."
She slightly stooped her shoulders to receive it, and the pretty girl lightly dropped it in its place. The Frenchwoman stood unnoticed, looking on with her lips very tightly set.
"I am sorry," said Lady Dedlock to Mr. Jarndyce, "that we are not likely to renew our former acquaintance. You will allow me to send the carriage back for your two wards. I shall be here directly."
But as he would on no account accept this offer, she took a graceful leave of Ada, none of me, and put her hand upon his proffered arm, and got into the carriage, which was a little, low, park carriage with a hood.
"Come in, child," she said to the pretty girl. "I shall want you. Go on."
The carriage rolled away, and the Frenchwoman, with the wrappers she had brought hanging over her arm, remained standing where she had alighted. I suppose there is nothing pride can so little bear with as pride itself, and that she was punished for her imperious manner. Her retaliation was the most singular I could have imagined. She remained perfectly still until the carriage had turned into the drive, and then, without the least discomposure of countenance, slipped off her shoes, left them on the ground, and walked deliberately in the same direction through the wettest of the wet grass.
"Is that young woman mad?" said my guardian.
"Oh, no, sir," said the keeper, who, with his wife, was looking after her. "Hortense is not one of that sort. She has as good a headpiece as the best. But she's mortal high and passionate, powerful high and passionate, and what with having notice to leave and having others put above her, she don't take kindly to it."
"But why should she walk shoeless through all that water?" said my guardian.
"Why, indeed, sir, unless it is to cool her down," said the man.
"Or unless she fancies it's blood," said the woman. "She'd as soon walk through that as anything else, I think, when her own's up."
We passed not far from the house a few minutes afterwards. Peaceful as it had looked when we first saw it, it looked even more so now, with a diamond spray glittering all about it, a light wind blowing. The birds no longer hushed, but singing strongly, everything refreshed by the late rain, and the little carriage shining at the doorway like a fairy carriage made of silver. Still, very steadfastly and quietly walking towards it, a peaceful figure, too, in the landscape, went Mademoiselle Hortense, shoeless, through the wet grass. Chapter 19. Moving On. It is the long vacation in the regions of Chancery Lane. The good ships Law and Equity, those teak-built, copper-bottomed, iron-fastened, brazen-faced, and not by any means fast-sailing clippers, are laid up in ordinary. The Flying Dutchman, with a crew of ghostly clients imploring all whom they may encounter to peruse their papers, has drifted, for the time being, heaven knows where. The courts are all shut up. The public offices lie in a hot sleep. Westminster Hall itself is a shady solitude where nightingales might sing, and a tenderer class of suitors than is usually found there walk. The Temple, Chancery Lane, Sergeant's Inn and Lincoln's Inn, even unto the fields, are like tidal harbours at low water, where stranded proceedings, offices at anchor, idle clerks lounging on lopsided stools that will not recover their perpendicular until the current of term sets in, lie high and dry upon the ooze of the long vacation. Outer doors of chambers are shut up by the score. Messages and parcels are to be left at the porter's lodge by the bushel. A crop of grass would grow in the chinks of the stone pavement outside Lincoln's Inn Hall, but that the ticket porters, who have nothing to do beyond sitting in the shade there with their white aprons over their heads to keep the flies off, grub it up and eat it thoughtfully. There is only one judge in town. Even he only comes twice a week to sit in chambers. If the country folks of those assize towns on his circuit could see him now, no full-bottomed wig, no red petticoats, no fur, no javelin men, no white wands, merely a close-shaved gentleman in white trousers and a white hat, with sea bronze on the judicial countenance, and a strip of bark peeled by the solar rays from the judicial nose, who calls in at the shellfish shop as he comes along and drinks iced ginger beer. The Bar of England is scattered over the face of the earth. How England can get on through 4 long summer months without its bar, which is its acknowledged refuge in adversity and its only legitimate triumph in prosperity, is beside the question. Assuredly, that shield and buckler of Britannia are not in present wear. The learned gentleman, who is always so tremendously indignant at the unprecedented outrage committed on the feelings of his client by the opposite party that he never seems likely to recover it, is doing infinitely better than might be expected in Switzerland. The learned gentleman who does the withering business, and who blights all opponents with his gloomy sarcasm, is as merry as a grig at a French watering place. The learned gentleman who weeps by the pint on the smallest provocation has not shed a tear these 6 weeks. The very learned gentleman who has cooled the natural heat of his gingery complexion in pools and fountains of law until he has become great in knotty arguments for term time, when he poses the drowsy bench with legal chaff, inexplicable to the uninitiated, and to most of the initiated too, is roaming, with a characteristic delight in aridity and dust, about Constantinople. Other dispersed fragments of the same great palladium are to be found on the canals of Venice, at the second cataract of the Nile, in the baths of Germany, and sprinkled on the sea-sand all over the English coast. Scarcely one is to be encountered in the deserted region of Chancery Lane. If such a lonely member of the bar do flit across the waste and come upon a prowling suitor who is unable to leave off haunting the scenes of his anxiety, they frighten one another and retreat into opposite shades. It is the hottest long vacation known for many years. All the young clerks are madly in love, and according to their various degrees, pine for bliss with the beloved object at Margate, Ramsgate, or Gravesend. All the middle-aged clerks think their families too large. All the unowned dogs who stray into the inns of court and pant about staircases and other dry places, seeking water, give short howls of aggravation. All the blind men's dogs in the streets draw their masters against pumps or trip them over buckets. A shop with a sun-blind and a watered pavement and a bowl of gold and silver fish in the window is a sanctuary. Temple Bar gets so hot that it is to the adjacent Strand and Fleet Street what a heater is in an urn, and keeps them simmering all night. There are offices about the Inns of Court in which a man might be cool if any coolness were worth purchasing at such a price in dullness. But the little thoroughfares immediately outside those retirements seem to blaze. In Mr. Crook's court it is so hot that the people turn their houses inside out and sit in chairs upon the pavement, Mr. Crook included, who there pursues his studies with his cat, who never is too hot, by his side. The Sol's Arms has discontinued the harmonic meetings for the season, and Little Swills is engaged to the pastoral gardens down the river, where he comes out in quite an innocent manner and sings comic ditties of a juvenile complexion calculated, as the bill says, not to wound the feelings of the most fastidious mind. Over all the legal neighbourhood there hangs, like some great veil of rust or gigantic cobweb, the idleness and pensiveness of the long vacation. Mr. Snagsby, law stationer of Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, is sensible of the influence not only in his mind as a sympathetic and contemplative man, but also in his business as a law stationer aforesaid. He has more leisure for musing in Staple Inn and in the Rolls Yard during the long vacation than at other seasons, and he says to the two prentices, "What a thing it is in such hot weather to think that you live in an island, with the sea a-rolling and a-bowling right round you." Gusta is busy in the little drawing-room on this present afternoon in the long vacation, when Mr. and Mrs. Snagsby have it in contemplation to receive company. The expected guests are rather select than numerous, being Mr. and Mrs. Chadband and no more. From Mr. Chadband's being much given to describe himself, both verbally and in writing, as a vessel, he is occasionally mistaken by strangers for a gentleman connected with navigation, but he is, as he expresses it, "in the ministry." Mr. Chadband is attached to no particular denomination, and is considered by his persecutors to have nothing so very remarkable to say on the greatest of subjects as to render his volunteering, on his own account, at all incumbent on his conscience. But he has his followers, and Mrs. Snagsby is of the number. Mrs. Snagsby has but recently taken a passage upward by the vessel Chadband, and her attention was attracted to that bark A1 when she was something flushed by the hot weather.
"My little woman," says Mr. Snagsby to the sparrows in Staple Inn, "likes to have her religion rather sharp, you see."
So Guster, much impressed by regarding herself for the time as the handmaid of Chadband, whom she knows to be endowed with the gift of holding forth for 4 hours at a stretch, prepares the little drawing-room for tea. All the furniture is shaken and dusted. The portraits of Mr. and Mrs. Snagsby are touched up with a wet cloth. The best tea service is set forth, and there is excellent provision made of dainty new bread, crusty twists, cool fresh butter, thin slices of ham, tongue, and German sausage, and delicate little rows of anchovies nestling in parsley, not to mention new-laid eggs, to be brought up warm in a napkin, and hot buttered toast. For Chadband is rather a consuming vessel, the persecutors say a gorging vessel, and can wield such weapons of the flesh as a knife and fork remarkably well. Mr. Snagsby, in his best coat, looking at all the preparations when they are completed, and coughing his cough of deference behind his hand, says to Mrs. Snagsby, "At what time did you expect Mr. and Mrs. Chadband, my love?" "At 6," says Mrs. Snagsby. Mr. Snagsby observes in a mild and casual way that, "It's gone, that." "Perhaps you'd like to begin without them," is Mrs. Snagsby's reproachful remark. Mr. Snagsby does look as if he would like it very much, but he says, with his cough of mildness, "No, my dear, no, I merely named the time." "What's time?" said Mrs. Snagsby. "To eternity." "Very true, my dear," says Mr. Snagsby. "Only when a person lays in victuals for tea, a person does it with a view, perhaps, more to time. And when a time is named for having tea, it's better to come up to it." "To come up to it," Mrs. Snagsby repeats with severity. "Up to it, as if Mr. Chadband was a fighter."
"Not at all, my dear," says Mr. Snagsby.
Here Guster, who had been looking out of the bedroom window, comes rustling and scratching down the little staircase like a popular ghost, and falling flushed into the drawing-room, announces that Mr. and Mrs. Chadband have appeared in the court. The bell at the inner door in the passage immediately thereafter tinkling, she is admonished by Mrs. Snagsby, on pain of instant reconsignment to her patron saint, not to omit the ceremony of announcement. Much discomposed in her nerves, which were previously in the best order by this threat, she so fearfully mutilates that point of state as to announce,
"Mr. and Mrs. Cheesmingleastwich, I mean to say, what's her name?"
and retires conscience-stricken from the presence. Mr. Chadband is a large yellow man with a fat smile and a general appearance of having a good deal of train oil in his system. Mrs. Chadband is a stern, severe-looking, silent woman. Mr. Chadband moves softly and cumbrously, not unlike a bear who has been taught to walk upright. He is very much embarrassed about the arms, as if they were inconvenient to him, and he wanted to grovel, is very much in a perspiration about the head, and never speaks without first putting up his great hand as delivering a token to his hearers that he is going to edify them.
"My friends," says Mr. Chadband, "peace be on this house, on the master thereof, on the mistress thereof, on the young maidens and on the young men. My friends, why do I wish for peace? What is peace? Is it war? No. Is it strife? No. Is it lovely and gentle and beautiful and pleasant and serene and joyful? Oh, yes. Therefore, my friends, I wish for peace upon you and upon yours."
In consequence of Mrs. Snagsby looking deeply edified, Mr. Snagsby thinks it expedient on the whole to say Amen, which is well received.
"Now, my friends," proceeds Mr. Chadband, "since I am upon this theme—"
Guster presents herself. Mrs. Snagsby, in a spectral bass voice and without removing her eyes from Chadband, says with dreadful distinctness,
"Go away."
"Now, my friends," says Chadband, "since I am upon this theme, and in my lowly path improving it—"
Guster is heard unaccountably to murmur, 1782. The spectral voice repeats more solemnly,
"Go away."
"Now, my friends," says Mr. Chadband, "we will inquire in a spirit of love."
Still Guster reiterates, 1782. Mr. Chadband, pausing with the resignation of a man accustomed to be persecuted, and languidly folding up his chin into his fat smile, says, "Let us hear the maiden. Speak, maiden."
1,782, if you please, sir, which he wished to know what the shilling were for,
says Guster, breathless.
For,
returns Mrs. Chadband.
For his fare.
Guster replied that
he insists on 1 and 8 pence, or on summonsing the party.
Mrs. Snagsby and Mrs. Chadband are proceeding to grow shrill in indignation when Mr. Chadband quiets the tumult by lifting up his hand.
"My friends," says he, "I remember a duty unfulfilled yesterday. It is right that I should be chastened in some penalty. I ought not to murmur. Rachel, pay the 8 pence."
While Mrs. Snagsby, drawing her breath, looks hard at Mr. Snagsby, as who should say, "You hear this, apostle?" And while Mr. Chadband glows with humility and train oil, Mrs. Chadband pays the money. It is Mr. Chadband's habit, it is the head and front of his pretensions indeed, to keep this sort of debtor and creditor account in the smallest items, and to post it publicly on the most trivial occasions.
"My friends," says Chadband, 8 pence is not much. It might justly have been 1 and 4 pence. It might justly have been 1/2 crown. Oh, let us be joyful, joyful. Oh, let us be joyful."
With which remark, which appears from its sound to be an extract in verse, Mr. Chadband stalks to the table, and before taking a chair, lifts up his admonitory hand.
"My friends," says he, "what is this which we now behold as being spread before us? Refreshment? Do we need refreshment, then, my friends? We do. And why do we need refreshment, my friends? Because we are but mortal, because we are but sinful, because we are but of the earth, because we are not of the air. Can we fly, my friends? We cannot. Why can we not fly, my friends?"
Mr. Snagsby, presuming on the success of his last point, ventures to observe in a cheerful and rather knowing tone, "No wings," but is immediately frowned down by Mrs. Snagsby.
"I say, my friends," pursues Mr. Chadband, utterly rejecting and obliterating Mr. Snagsby's suggestion, "why can we not fly? Is it because we are calculated to walk? It is. Could we walk, my friends, without strength? We could not. What should we do without strength, my friends? Our legs would refuse to bear us. Our knees would double up. Our ankles would turn over, and we should come to the ground. Then from whence, my friends, in a human point of view, do we derive the strength that is necessary to our limbs? Is it," says Chadband, glancing over the table, "from bread in various forms? From butter which is churned from the milk, which is yielded unto us by the cow? From the eggs which are laid by the fowl? From ham, from tongue, from sausage, and from such like? It is. Then let us partake of the good things which are set before us."
The persecutors denied that there was any particular gift in Mr. Chadband's piling verbose flights of stairs one upon another after this fashion. But this can only be received as a proof of their determination to persecute, since it must be within everyone's experience that the Chadband style of oratory is widely received and much admired. Mr. Chadband, however, having concluded for the present, sits down at Mr. Snagsby's table and lays about him prodigiously. The conversion of nutriment of any sort into oil of the quality already mentioned appears to be a process so inseparable from the constitution of this exemplary vessel that in beginning to eat and drink he may be described as always becoming a kind of considerable oil mills or other large factory for the production of that article on a wholesale scale. On the present evening of the long vacation, in Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, he does such a powerful stroke of business that the warehouse appears to be quite full when the works cease. At this period of the entertainment, Guster, who has never recovered her first failure, but has neglected no possible or impossible means of bringing the establishment and herself into contempt, among which may be briefly enumerated her unexpectedly performing clashing military music on Mr. Chadband's head with plates, and afterwards crowning that gentleman with muffins, at which period of the entertainment, Guster whispers Mr. Snagsby that he is wanted.
"And being in the, not to put too fine a point upon it, in the shop," says Mr. Snagsby, rising, "perhaps this good company will excuse me for half a minute."
Mr. Snagsby descends and finds the two prentices, intently contemplating a police constable, who holds a ragged boy by the arm.
"Why, bless my heart," says Mr. Snagsby, "what's the matter?"
"This boy," says the constable, "although he's repeatedly told to, won't move on."
"I'm always a-moving on, sir,"
cries the boy, wiping away his grimy tears with his arm.
"I've always been a-moving and a-moving on ever since I was born. Where can I possibly move to, sir, more nor I do move?"
"He won't move on,"
says the constable calmly, with a slight professional hitch of his neck involving its better settlement in his stiff stock,
"although he has been repeatedly cautioned, and therefore I am obliged to take him into custody. He's as obstinate a young gonoff as I know. He won't move on."
"Oh, my eye, where can I move to?"
cries the boy, clutching quite desperately at his hair and beating his bare feet upon the floor of Mr. Snagsby's passage.
"Don't you come none of that, or I shall make blessed short work of you,"
says the constable, giving him a passionless shake.
"My instructions are that you are to move on. I have told you so 500 times.
"But where?"
cries the boy.
"Well, really, constable, you know," says Mr. Snagsby, wistfully and coughing behind his hand his cough of great perplexity and doubt, "really, that does seem a question. Where, you know?"
"My instructions don't go to that," replies the constable. "My instructions are that this boy is to move on."
Do you hear, Joe? It is nothing to you or to anyone else that the great lights of the parliamentary sky have failed for some few years in this business to set you the example of moving on. The one grand recipe remains for you, the profound philosophical prescription, the be-all and the end-all of your strange existence upon earth. Move on. You are by no means to move off, Joe, for the great lights can't at all agree about that. Move on. Mr. Snagsby says nothing to this effect, says nothing at all indeed, but coughs his forlornest cough, expressive of no thoroughfare in any direction. By this time, Mr. and Mrs. Chadband and Mrs. Snagsby, hearing the altercation, have appeared upon the stairs. Guster having never left the end of the passage, the whole household are assembled.
"The simple question is, sir," says the constable, "whether you know this boy. He says you do."
Mrs. Snagsby, from her elevation, instantly cries out,
"No, he don't."
"My little woman," says Mr. Snagsby, looking up the staircase, "my love, permit me. Pray have a moment's patience, my dear. I do know something of this lad, and in what I know of him, I can't say that there's any harm. Perhaps, on the contrary, constable."
To whom the law stationer relates his joeful and woeful experience, suppressing the half-crown fact.
"Well," says the constable, "so far it seems he had grounds for what he said. When I took him into custody up in Oban, he said you knew him. Upon that, a young man who was in the crowd said he was acquainted with you, and you were a respectable housekeeper, and if I'd call and make the inquiry, he'd appear. The young man don't seem inclined to keep his word, but, oh, here is the young man."
Enter Mr. Guppy, who nods to Mr. Snagsby, and touches his hat with a chivalry of clerkship to the ladies on the stairs.
"I was strolling away from the office just now when I found this row going on," says Mr. Guppy to the law stationer. "And as your name was mentioned, I thought it was right the thing should be looked into."
"It was very good-natured of you, sir," says Mr. Snagsby, "and I am obliged to you."
And Mr. Snagsby again relates his experience, again suppressing the half-crown fact.
"Now, I know where you live," says the constable then to Joe. "You live down in Tom All Alone's. That's a nice innocent place to live, ain't it?"
"I can't go and live in no nicer place, sir," replies Joe. "They wouldn't have nothing to say to me if I was to go to a nice innocent place for to live. Who'd go and let a nice innocent lodging to such a regular one as me?"
"You are very poor, ain't you?"
says the constable.
"Yes, I am, sir. Very poor in general," replies Joe.
"I leave you to judge now. I shook these 2 half-crowns out of him," says the constable, producing them to the company, "in only putting my hand upon him."
"They're what's left, Mr. Snagsby," says Joe.
out of a sovereign as was given me by a lady in a whale as said she was a servant, and has come to my crossing one night and asked to be showed this here house, and the house what him as you give the writing to died at, and the burying ground what he's buried in. She says to me, she says, "Are you the boy at the Inkwitch?" she says. I says, "Yes," I says. She says to me, she says, "Can you show me all them places?" I says, "Yes, I can," I says. And she says to me, "Do it," and I done it, and she give me a sovereign and hooked it. "And I ain't had much of the sovereign neither," says Joe with dirty tears, "for I had to pay 5 bob down in Tom Hall alone afore they'd square it for to give me change. And any young man he thieved another 5 while I was asleep, and another boy he thieved 9, and the landlord he stood drains round with a lot more on it."
"You don't expect anybody to believe this about the lady and the sovereign, do you?"
says the constable, eyeing him aside with ineffable disdain. "I don't know as I do, sir," replies Joe. "I don't expect nothing at all, sir, much, but that's the true history on it."
"You see what he is?" the constable observes to the audience. "Well, Mr. Snagsby, if I don't lock him up this time, will you engage for his moving on?"
"No," cries Mrs. Snagsby from the stairs. "My little woman," pleads her husband. "Constable, I have no doubt he'll move on. You know you really must do it," says Mr. Snagsby.
"I'm every ways agreeable, sir," says the hapless Joe.
"Do it, then," observes the constable. "You know what you have got to do. Do it. And recollect you won't get off so easy next time. Catch hold of your money. Now, the sooner you're 5 mile off, the better for all parties."
With this farewell hint, and pointing generally to the setting sun as a likely place to move on to, the constable bids his auditors good afternoon, and makes the echoes of Cook's Court perform slow music for him as he walks away on the shady side, carrying his iron-bound hat in his hand for a little ventilation. Now, Joe's improbable story concerning the lady and the sovereign has awakened more or less the curiosity of all the company. Mr. Guppy, who has an inquiring mind in matters of evidence, and who has been suffering severely from the lassitude of the long vacation, takes that interest in the case that he enters on a regular cross-examination of the witness, which is found so interesting by the ladies that Mrs. Snagsby politely invites him to step upstairs and drink a cup of tea, if he will excuse the disarranged state of the tea-table, consequent on their previous exertions. Mr. Guppy, yielding his assent to this proposal, Joe is requested to follow into the drawing-room doorway, where Mr. Guppy takes him in hand as a witness, patting him into this shape, that shape, and the other shape, like a butterman dealing with so much butter, and worrying him according to the best models. Nor is the examination unlike many such model displays, both in respect of its eliciting nothing and of its being lengthy, for Mr. Guppy is sensible of his talent, and Mrs. Snagsby feels not only that it gratifies her inquisitive disposition, but that it lifts her husband's establishment higher up in the law. During the progress of this keen encounter, the vessel Chadband, being merely engaged in the oil trade, gets aground and waits to be floated off. "Well," says Mr. Guppy, "either this boy sticks to it like cobbler's wax, or there is something out of the common here that beats anything that ever came into my way at Kenge and Carboy's." Mrs. Chadband whispers Mrs. Snagsby, who exclaims, "You don't say so!" "4 years," replied Mrs. Chadband. "Has known Kenge and Carboy's office for years," Mrs. Snagsby triumphantly explains to Mr. Guppy. "Mrs. Chadband, this gentleman's wife, Reverend Mr. Chadband." "Oh, indeed," says Mr. Guppy. "Before I married my present husband," says Mrs. Chadband. "Was you a party in anything, ma'am?" says Mr. Guppy, transferring his cross-examination. "No." "Not a party in anything, ma'am?" says Mr. Guppy. Mrs. Chadband shakes her head. "Perhaps you were acquainted with somebody who was a party in something, ma'am," says Mr. Guppy, who likes nothing better than to model his conversation on forensic principles. "Not exactly that either," replies Mrs. Chadband, humouring the joke with a hard-favoured smile. "Not exactly that either," repeats Mr. Guppy. "Very good. Pray, ma'am, was it a lady of your acquaintance who had some transactions, we will not at present say what transactions, with Kenge and Carboy's office, or was it a gentleman of your acquaintance? Take time, ma'am. We shall come to it presently. Man or woman, ma'am?"
"Neither,"
says Mrs. Chadband as before.
"Oh, a child," says Mr. Guppy, throwing on the admiring Mrs. Snagsby the regular acute professional eye which is thrown on British jurymen. "Now, ma'am, perhaps you'll have the kindness to tell us What child?
You have got it at last, sir, says Mrs. Chadband, with another hard-favoured smile. Well, sir, it was before your time, most likely, judging from your appearance. I was left in charge of a child named Esther Summerson, who was put out in life by Messrs. Kenge and Carboy.
Miss Summerson, ma'am? Cries Mr. Guppy, excited.
I call her Esther Summerson, says Mrs. Chadband, with austerity. There was no missing of the girl in my time. It was Esther. Esther do this, Esther do that, and she was made to do it.
My dear ma'am, returns Mr. Guppy, moving across the small apartment. The humble individual who now addresses you received that young lady in London when she first came here from the establishment to which you have alluded. Allow me to have the pleasure of taking you by the hand.
Mr. Chadband, at last seeing his opportunity, makes his accustomed signal and rises with a smoking head, which he dabs with his pocket handkerchief. Mrs. Snagsby whispers, "Hush!"
"My friends," says Chadband, "we have partaken in moderation,"
which was certainly not the case, so far as he was concerned,
"of the comforts which have been provided for us. May this house live upon the fatness of the land. May corn and wine be plentiful therein. May it grow, may it thrive, may it prosper, may it advance, may it proceed, may it press forward. But, my friends, have we partaken of anything else?"
"We have."
"My friends, of what else have we partaken?" "Of spiritual profit?"
"Yes.
From whence have we derived that spiritual profit? My young friend, stand forth."
Joe, thus apostrophized, gives a slouch backward, and another slouch forward, and another slouch to each side, and confronts the eloquent Chadband with evident doubts of his intentions.
"My young friend," says Chadband, "you are to us a pearl, you are to us a diamond, you are to us a gem, you are to us a jewel. And why, my young friend?"
"I don't know," replies Joe. "I don't know nothink."
"My young friend," says Chadband, "it is because you know nothing that you are to us a gem and jewel. For what are you, my young friend? Are you a beast of the field? No. A bird of the air? No. A fish of the sea or river? No. You are a human boy, my young friend. A human boy. Oh, glorious to be a human boy. And why glorious, my young friend? Because you are capable of receiving the lessons of wisdom. Because you are capable of profiting by this discourse which I now deliver for your good. Because you are not a stick or a staff or a stock or a stone or a post or a pillar. Oh, running stream of sparkling joy, to be a soaring human boy. And do you cool yourself in that stream now, my young friend? No. Why do you not cool yourself in that stream now? Because you are in a state of darkness, because you are in a state of obscurity, because you are in a state of sinfulness, because you are in a state of bondage. My young friend, what is bondage? Let us, in spirit of love, inquire."
At this threatening stage of the discourse, Joe, who seems to have been gradually going out of his mind, smears his right arm over his face and gives a terrible yawn. Mrs. Snagsby indignantly expresses her belief that he is a limb of the arch-fiend.
"My friends," says Mr. Chadband, with his persecuted chin folding itself into its fat smile again as he looks round, "it is right that I should be humbled. It is right that I should be tried. It is right that I should be mortified. It is right that I should be corrected. I stumbled on Sabbath last, when I thought with pride of my 3 hours improving. The account is now favourably balanced. My creditor has accepted a composition. Oh, let us be joyful, joyful! Oh, let us be joyful!"
Great sensation on the part of Mrs. Snagsby.
"My friends," says Chadband, looking round him in conclusion, "I will not proceed with my young friend now. Will you come tomorrow, my young friend, and inquire of this good lady where I am to be found to deliver a discourse unto you? And will you come like the thirsty swallow upon the next day, and upon the day after that, and upon the day after that, and upon many pleasant days to hear discourses?" This with a cow-like lightness.
Joe,
whose immediate object seems to be to get away on any terms, gives a shuffling nod. Mr. Guppy then throws him a penny, and Mrs. Snagsby calls to Guster to see him safely out of the house. But before he goes downstairs, Mr. Snagsby loads him with some broken meats from the table, which he carries away, hugging in his arms. So Mr. Chadband, of whom the persecutors say that it is no wonder he should go on for any length of time uttering such abominable nonsense, but that the wonder rather is that he should ever leave off, having once the audacity to begin, retires into private life until he invests a little capital of supper in the oil trade. Joe moves on, through the long vacation, down to Blackfriars Bridge, where he finds a baking stony corner wherein to settle to his repast. And there he sits, munching and gnawing, and looking up at the great cross on the summit of St. Paul's Cathedral, glittering above a red and violet-tinted cloud of smoke. From the boy's face, one might suppose that sacred emblem to be, in his eyes, the crowning confusion of the great confused city, so golden, so high up, so far out of his reach. There he sits, the sun going down, the river running fast, the crowd flowing by him in two streams, everything moving on to some purpose and to one end, until he is stirred up and told to move on too. Chapter 20. A New Lodger. The long vacation saunters on towards term time like an idle river very leisurely strolling down a flat country to the sea. Mr. Guppy saunters along with it congenially. He has blunted the blade of his penknife and broken the point off by sticking that instrument into his desk in every direction. Not that he bears the desk any ill will, but he must do something, and it must be something of an unexciting nature which will lay neither his physical nor his intellectual energies under too heavy contribution. He finds that nothing agrees with him so well as to make little gyrations on one leg of his stool and stab his desk and gape. Kenge and Carboy are out of town, and the articled clerk has taken out a shooting license and gone down to his father's, and Mr. Guppy's two fellow stipendiaries are away on leave. Mr. Guppy and Mr. Richard Carstone divide the dignity of the office. But Mr. Carstone is for the time being established in Kenge's room, whereat Mr. Guppy chafes, so exceedingly that he with biting sarcasm informs his mother, in the confidential moments when he sups with her off a lobster and lettuce in the Old Street Road, that he is afraid the office is hardly good enough for swells, and that if he had known there was a swell coming, he would have got it painted. Mr. Guppy suspects everybody who enters on the occupation of a stool in Kenge and Carboy's office of entertaining, as a matter of course, sinister designs upon him. He is clear that every such person wants to depose him. If he be ever asked how, why, when, or wherefore, he shuts up one eye and shakes his head. On the strength of these profound views, he in the most ingenious manner takes infinite pains to counterplot when there is no plot, and plays the deepest games of chess without any adversary. It is a source of much gratification to Mr. Guppy, therefore, to find the newcomer constantly poring over the papers in Jarndyce and Jarndyce, for he well knows that nothing but confusion and failure can come of that. His satisfaction communicates itself to a third saunterer through the long vacation in Kenge and Carboy's office, to wit, young Smallweed. Whether young Smallweed, metaphorically called Small, and eke Chickweed, as it were jocularly to express a fledgling, was ever a boy, is much doubted in Lincoln's Inn. He is now something under 15, and an old limb of the law. He is facetiously understood to entertain a passion for a lady at a cigar shop, in the neighbourhood of Chancery Lane, and for her sake to have broken off a contract with another lady, to whom he had been engaged some years. He is a town-made article of small stature and wizen features, but may be perceived from a considerable distance by means of his very tall hat. To become a Guppy is the object of his ambition. He dresses at that gentleman by whom he is patronized, talks at him, walks at him, founds himself entirely on him. He is honored with Mr. Guppy's particular confidence, and occasionally advises him, from the deep wells of his experience, on difficult points in private life. Mr. Guppy has been lolling out of window all the morning, after trying all the stools in succession and finding none of them easy, and after several times putting his head into the iron safe with a notion of cooling it. Mr. Smallweed has been twice dispatched for effervescent drinks, and has twice mixed them in the two official tumblers and stirred them up with the ruler. Mr. Guppy propounds for Mr. Smallweed's consideration the paradox that the more you drink, the thirstier you are, and reclines his head upon the window-sill in a state of hopeless languor. While thus looking out into the shade of Old Square, Lincoln's Inn, surveying the intolerable bricks and mortar, Mr. Guppy becomes conscious of a manly whisker emerging from the cloistered walk below and turning itself up in the direction of his face. At the same time, a low whistle is wafted through the inn, and a suppressed voice cries,
"Hip! Guppy!"
"Why, you don't mean it," says Mr. Guppy, aroused. "Small, here's Jobling." Small's head looks out of window, too, and nods to Jobling. "Where have you sprung up from?" inquires Mr. Guppy.
"From the market gardens down by Deptford. I can't stand it any longer. I must enlist. I say, I wish you'd lend me half a crown. Upon my soul, I'm hungry."
Jobling looks hungry, and also has the appearance of having run to seed in the market gardens down by Deptford.
"I say, just throw out half a crown if you've got one to spare. I want to get some dinner."
"Will you come and dine with me?" says Mr. Guppy, throwing out the coin, which Mr. Jobling catches neatly.
"How long should I have to hold out?" says Jobling.
"Not half an hour. I'm only waiting here till the enemy goes," returns Mr. Guppy, butting inward with his head.
"What enemy?"
"A new one, going to be articled. Will you wait?"
"Can you give a fellow anything to read in the meantime?"
says Mr. Jobling. Smallweed suggests the law list, but Mr. Jobling declares with much earnestness that he
can't stand it.
"You shall have the paper," says Mr. Guppy. "He shall bring it down, but you had better not be seen about here. Sit on our staircase and read. It's a quiet place." Jobling nods intelligence and acquiescence. The sagacious Smallweed supplies him with a newspaper, and occasionally drops his eye upon him from the landing as a precaution against his becoming disgusted with waiting and making an untimely departure. At last the enemy retreats, and then Smallweed fetches Mr. Jobling up.
"Well, and how are you?" says Mr. Guppy, shaking hands with him.
So-so, how are you?"
Mr. Guppy replying that he has not much to boast of, Mr. Jobling ventures on the question,
"How is she?"
This Mr. Guppy resents as a liberty, retorting, "Jobling, there are chords in the human mind." Jobling begs pardon. "Any subject but that," says Mr. Guppy, with a gloomy enjoyment of his injury, "for there are chords, Jobling." Mr. Jobling begs pardon again. During this short colloquy, the active Smallweed, who is of the dinner party, has written in legal characters on a slip of paper, "Return immediately." This notification, to all whom it may concern, he inserts in the letter-box. And then, putting on the tall hat at the angle of inclination at which Mr. Guppy wears his, informs his patron that they may now make themselves scarce. Accordingly, they betake themselves to a neighbouring dining-house, of the class known among its frequenters by the denomination Slap-Bang, where the waitress, a bouncing young female of 40, is supposed to have made some impression on the susceptible Smallweed, of whom it may be remarked that he is a weird changeling to whom years are nothing. He stands precociously possessed of centuries of owlish wisdom. If he ever lay in a cradle, it seems as if he must have lain there in a tailcoat. He has an old, old eye, has Smallweed, and he drinks and smokes in a monkeyish way, and his neck is stiff in his collar, and he is never to be taken in, and he knows all about it, whatever it is. In short, in his bringing up, he has been so nursed by law and equity that he has become a kind of fossil imp, to account for whose terrestrial existence it is reported at the public offices that his father was John Doe, and his mother the only female member of the Roe family, also that his first long clothes were made from a blue bag. Into the dining-house, unaffected by the seductive show in the window of artificially whitened cauliflowers and poultry, verdant baskets of peas, coolly blooming cucumbers, and joints ready for the spit, Mr. Smallweed leads the way. They know him there, and defer to him. He has his favourite box. He bespeaks all the papers. He is down upon bald patriarchs, who keep them more than 10 minutes afterwards. It is of no use trying him with anything less than a full-sized bread, or proposing to him any joint in cut unless it is in the very best cut. In the matter of gravy, he is adamant. Conscious of his elfin power and submitting to his dread experience, Mr. Guppy consults him in the choice of that day's banquet, turning an appealing look towards him as the waitress repeats the catalogue of viands and saying, "What do you take, Chick?" Chick, out of the profundity of his artfulness, preferring, "Veal and ham and French beans, and don't you forget the stuffing, Polly," with an unearthly cock of his venerable eye. Mr. Guppy and Mr. Jobling give the like order. 3-pint pots of half and half are superadded. Quickly the waitress returns, bearing what is apparently a model of the Tower of Babel, but what is really a pile of plates and flat tin dish covers. Mr. Smallweed, approving of what is set before him, conveys intelligent benignity into his ancient eye, and winks upon her. Then, amid a constant coming in and going out and running about, and a clatter of crockery, and a rumbling up and down of the machine which brings the nice cuts from the kitchen, and a shrill crying for more nice cuts down the speaking pipe, and a shrill reckoning of the cost of nice cuts that have been disposed of, and a general flush and steam of hot joints, cut and uncut, and a considerably heated atmosphere in which the soiled knives and tablecloths seem to break out spontaneously into eruptions of grease and blotches of beer, the legal triumvirate appease their appetites. Mr. Jobling is buttoned up closer than mere adornment might require. His hat presents at the rims a peculiar appearance of a glistening nature, as if it had been a favourite snail promenade. The same phenomenon is visible on some parts of his coat, and particularly at the seams. He has the faded appearance of a gentleman in embarrassed circumstances. Even his light whiskers droop with something of a shabby air. His appetite is so vigorous that it suggests spare living for some little time back. He makes such a speedy end of his plate of veal and ham, bringing it to a close while his companions are yet midway in theirs, that Mr. Guppy proposes another.
"Thank you, Guppy," says Mr. Jobling. "I really don't know, but what I will take another."
Another being brought, he falls to with great goodwill. Mr. Guppy takes silent notice of him at intervals until he is halfway through this second plate, and stops to take an enjoying pull at his pint pot of half and half, also renewed, and stretches out his legs and rubs his hands. Beholding him in which glow of contentment, Mr. Guppy says,
"You are a man again, Tony."
"Well, not quite yet," says Mr. Jobling. "Say just born."
"Will you take any other vegetables? Grass, peas, summer cabbage?"
"Thank you, Guppy," says Mr. Jobling. "I really don't know but what I will take summer cabbage."
Order given, with a sarcastic addition from Mr. Smallweed of, "Without slugs, Polly," and cabbage produced.
"I am growing up, Guppy,"
says Mr. Jobling, plying his knife and fork with a relishing steadiness. "Glad to hear it."
"In fact, I've just turned into my teens," says Mr. Jobling.
He says no more until he has performed his task, which he achieves as Messrs. Guppy and Smallweed finish theirs, thus getting over the ground in excellent style and beating those two gentlemen easily by a veal and ham and a cabbage. "Now, Small," says Mr. Guppy, "what would you recommend about pastries?"
"Marrow puddings," says Mr. Smallweed instantly.
"Aye, aye,"
cries Mr. Jobling with an arch look.
"You're there, are you? Thank you, Mr. Guppy, I don't know but what I will take a marrow pudding."
3 marrow puddings being produced, Mr. Jobling adds in a pleasant humour that he is coming of age fast. To these succeed, by command of Mr. Smallweed, 3 Cheshires, and to those 3 small rums. This apex of the entertainment happily reached, Mr. Jobling puts up his legs on the carpeted seat, having his own side of the box to himself, leans against the wall and says,
"I'm grown up now, Guppy. I've arrived at maturity."
"What do you think now," says Mr. Guppy, "about... you don't mind Smallweed?"
"Not the least in the world. I have the pleasure of drinking his good health."
"Sir, to you," says Mr. Smallweed.
"I was saying, what do you think now," pursues Mr. Guppy, "of enlisting?"
"Why, what I may think after dinner," returns Mr. Jobling, "is one thing, my dear Guppy, and what I may think before dinner is another thing. Still, even after dinner, I ask myself the question, what am I to do? How am I to live? Ill for manger, you know," says Mr. Jobling, pronouncing that word as if he meant a necessary fixture in an English stable. "Ill for manger, that's the French saying, and
"'Mangering is as necessary to me as it is to a Frenchman, or more so.'
"'Mr. Smallweed is decidedly of opinion, much more so.'
"'If any man had told me,' pursues Jobling, "'even so lately as when you and I had the frisk down in Lincolnshire, Guppy, "'and drove over to see that house at Castle Wold?'
"'Mr. Smallweed corrects him. "'Chesney Wold.'
"'Chesney Wold, I thank my honourable friend for that cheer, "'if any man had told me then that I should be as hard up at the present time "'as I literally find myself, I should have... "'Well, I should have pitched into him,' says Mr. Jobling, "'taking a little rum and water with an air of desperate resignation. "'I should have let fly at his head.'
"'Still, Tony, you were on the wrong side of the post then,' "'remonstrates Mr. Guppy. "'You were talking about nothing else in the gig.'
"'Guppy!'
says Mr. Jobling.
I will not deny it.